Hello, everybody, and welcome to New Books in Gender Studies. I'm Julie Fetty, host of the channel, and today we'll be talking to Jenny Kaminer about her new book, Women with a Thirst for Destruction, The Bad Mother in Russian Culture. This is published by Northwestern University Press in 2014. Jenny is an assistant professor of Russian at UC Davis. Her PhD is in Slavic languages and literatures from Northwestern University. And the book that we'll be discussing today won the 2014 Helt Prize from the Association for Women in Slavic Studies. So welcome, Jenny.
Thank you very much for having me.
Could you begin, Jenny, by just telling us a little bit about yourself?
Sure. Well, as you mentioned, I received my PhD in Slavic languages and literatures from Northwestern in 2006, and the book that we'll be discussing today was originally my dissertation project. And I'm from a Ukrainian family, Jewish Ukrainian family, who emigrated to the U.S. in 1980. So I grew up hearing Russian and being exposed to, we were Russian-speaking Ukrainian Jews. So I grew up, you know, exposed to the language and exposed to the culture on a basic level. And then I ended up pursuing my BA and my master's and PhD in Russian literature and Russian culture. So that's how I originally came to be interested in the topic as a whole. And I've been at UC Davis since 2009. I had a couple of visiting positions prior to that. I spent a year teaching at the University of Sheffield in England in their Department of Russian and Slavonic Studies. And before that, I was a visiting assistant professor at Oberlin College in Oberlin, Ohio. So I've been a bit peripatetic in my academic career, but I'm happy to have settled here at UC Davis.
Excellent. So how did you come to write Women with a Thirst for Destruction? What a great title, by the way.
You know, thanks. You know, it's interesting. I only realized after the fact that it has this non-intentional Almodovar reference or echo, which several people pointed out to me, which was not, you know, my intention in selecting the title. But the title is actually, the first part of the title is actually a quote from a 1991 novella by a well-known contemporary Russian writer named Lyudmila Petrushevskaya, one of the texts that I write about in the last chapter of the book. And in fact, it was that book, which I read in my first year in graduate school, that really got me thinking about this topic of bad motherhood. And if you know even just a little bit about Russian culture, you've probably heard the term Mother Russia, which gives you immediately kind of some insights into how central, how important this motif is for sort of Russians' self-definition, for their thinking about themselves. And I was recently thinking, my choice of topic was recently reaffirmed by a recent New Yorker profile of Mikhail Khodorkovsky, this oligarch who was recently released from prison by Vladimir Putin. And they were asking, the interviewer was asking Putin, well, why did you, you know, after many unsuccessful appeals, why did you finally agree to let Mikhail Khodorkovsky out of prison? And he said, well, it was not, you know, because I thought he was a model prisoner or anything. It was because I was informed that his mother was terminally ill, and a mother in Russia is something sacred. So I guess I read this novella by Lyudmila Petrushevskaya from the early 1990s that features this just really monstrous, kind of demonic, unstable maternal narrative. And it got me thinking about, you know, what does it mean to be a bad mother in the context of a culture that has revered maternity so fervently, so incessantly, really from its Christian and even pre-Christian roots. So I started kind of chronologically. My book spans from roughly the mid second half of the 19th century to the post-Soviet period. But I ended up kind of formulating my ideas sort of backwards. So the post-Soviet chapter was the one that took form first. You know, sort of structured around this one particular literary work, and then it took on additional dimensions from there. And then in the course of thinking about, well, you know, how do I make this into, you know, a larger project? What is the significance of negative maternity in the context of a culture that has revered maternity so incessantly from its pre-Christian and Christian roots? And so I started in the post-Soviet period, and then the question eventually kind of grew to what happens to firmly rooted, firmly entrenched cultural myths in periods of exceptional societal upheaval, societal shift. And so that, I think, is kind of, that's the meta question that I think informs my research as a whole and certainly underlies the foundation for this book. So I start with the 1990s, and then from there, I picked two other periods that I think are periods of exceptional societal upheaval and shift beginning from Imperial Russia and into the Soviet period. So I chose the 1920s, which is the decade. So everyone knows, of course, that the Russian Revolution took place in 1917. One of the earliest pieces of legislation that the Bolsheviks passed was a family law in 1918 that basically kind of threw out all of the traditional foundations upon which the Russian family had been founded. Bolshevik state was obviously an atheist state, so they got rid of church marriage, church divorce. If you wanted, you know, divorce was something that was extremely complicated and very difficult to achieve during the Imperial Russian period, and under the new Bolshevik regime, all you had to do if you wanted to get married or divorced was go to the civil registry office and say, hey, I want to get married. And if you're done being married, all you had to do was go back to that same civil registry office and say, hey, I'm done being married. I want to be divorced. They got rid of the category of illegitimacy for children, a whole slew of really profound changes to this fundamental institution of the family that was. And all of these changes were designed to hasten what was termed the quote unquote withering away. And that was exactly the term that the Bolshevik ideologues from that period employed to hasten or to speed up the so-called withering away of the traditional family. So so that was why I chose the 1920s as kind of the period immediately after all of these profound changes, societal, legislative changes to the institution of the family had been implemented in the wake of the Bolshevik Revolution and before the 1929 Stalinist Revolution. So I wanted in particular to focus on that first decade of the Soviet state. And then, so I ended up actually writing the book, chronologically, writing the dissertation and then reworking the book chronologically backwards. I wrote the 1990s chapter first, and then I wrote the 1920s chapter. And then finally I wrote the earliest chapter, which focuses on two canonical texts from the 1870s. And my choice of the 1870s, again, is motivated by sort of looking at a period that experienced, you know, dramatic societal rupture. The 1860s into the 1870s in Imperial Russian history is known as the period of the Great Reforms. So beginning most climactically with the emancipation of the serfs in 1861. So Russia had been a serf-owning society up until that point. And along with the emancipation of the serfs, you had all kinds of other very meaningful societal changes, you know, educational changes, changes to the legal system, the introduction of jury trials, changes to the system of military conscription. So it was, and in the 1870s, you also had along with that sort of had the beginning of the project of Tsar Alexander II to modernize the Russian state, to modernize Russian society. And then in the 1870s, so contemporaneous with the two novels that I focus on, you also have the rise of radical movements. So the beginnings of political terrorism that ultimately culminated with the assassination of the Tsar in 1881. Alongside the great reforms of Alexander II, you also had the emergence of what was called the women's question in Russian society, Russian history. So during this period of sort of societal shift and fomenting of these fundamental changes, you had a reconsideration of, you know, women's role in society, the beginnings of you know, women being allowed to attend higher education courses and so on, to have access to higher education, in a meaningful way that had not been, you know, possible up until that point. So you have sort of all of this discussion about, you know, what is the role of women in society? You know, what will the family of the future look like? What will our society of the future look like? Alongside, you know, these the beginning of these radical movements that, of course, culminated in 1881 with the assassination of the Tsar, but ultimately culminated in the Russian Revolution of 1917, sort of the beginnings of all of that upheaval took place in this period of time where these two novels are set and are written.
So Jenny, before we talk about the effects that these massive changes had on Russian families and particularly Russian mothers, can you just take us a little bit backward before the abolition of serfdom, before the great reforms? What were the principal values underlining the good Russian family and particularly the good mother?
Yeah, I mean, that's a great question. And I try to address that in my introductory chapter where I trace the roots of the maternal ideal, the maternal icon, you know, back through Russian Orthodoxy, but even earlier than that to its pre-Christian or to its pagan roots. So the pagan Slavic tribes worshipped a maternal divinity called Moist Mother Earth, right? And, you know, she has that particular maternal figure, that that maternal object of reverence, has much in common with other pre-Christian mother goddesses, right? For which we have evidence that early European people revered. So you know, the embodiment of the earth as a womb, and you know, wielding all of this power to be both creative and also destructive. So a maternal goddess that was dual in a way that later maternal objects of worship were not allowed to be. And my argument is that, and I'm recapitulating arguments that have been made by other scholars, is that when the Slavic tribes, when Rus became Christian in the 10th century, that much of what had been a component of the worship of this pre-Christian maternal goddess, this Moist Mother Earth, that eventually migrated and became part of the Mother of God icon in Russian Orthodoxy. And I stress one very particularly important difference between the maternal icon in Russian Orthodoxy versus in the Western Church versus in Catholicism, and that is that, you know, Mary, the Mother of God in the Russian Orthodox tradition, was very much always a mother and not a virgin. So this aspect of virginity and all of those Catholic doctrines really trying to institutionalize Mary's virginity, that was not so not so central to, especially among, you know, popular believers, that was not such a central aspect of Mary's profile. And so you see that reflected in visual culture from the medieval period, right? The medieval icons, you know, she's portrayed as a mother, then with the virginity much more secondary. Mm-hmm. And there are certain traits or fundamental qualities that were attributed to the Mary, the Mother of God icon that became, and this is what I argue in my introduction, that became part of the myth of the good mother in Russian culture that all Russian mothers were meant to emulate. And one of those is her mediating function, right? So Mary, the Mother of God, according to Russian Orthodox belief, was meant to serve as a mediator or an intercessor, right, between the sinful people on earth and the divine. And she was meant to mediate conflict, to sort of to bring potentially conflicting elements into harmony, and that this becomes, so this aspect of Mary as Mary, Mother of God, becomes part of the myth of the good Russian mother, that all Russian mothers were supposed to, a quality that all Russian mothers were supposed to embody.
Okay. So how did the great reforms and the abolition of serfdom affect families and affect this vision of mother as mediator and as self-sacrificing?
Mm-hmm. Well, first of all, especially for women of the nobility and of the aristocracy, the great reforms meant that they could no longer, I guess most, most fundamentally, that they could no longer rely they no longer had access to, you know, reliable, free childcare, right? So you start to see in the 1860s the emergence of advice literature and popular literature that is designed to actually, you know, help, you know, women of the nobility who might not have been so involved in kind of the daily tasks of childcare sort of learn to actually take much more of a hands-on role than they had previously been compelled to do.
What about mothers formerly serf mothers then? How did their families change?
Well, usually, I guess I would say the changes that serf families experienced were probably not as profound as one might expect. For the most part, the abolition of serfdom didn't really change day-to-day life for the majority of serfs. The way that they were allotted land was extremely chaotic and inefficient, and you know most serfs ended up sort of staying put where they were just without sort of the oversight of a noble landlord. But I think when you have the emergence of these radical movements who are kind of calling for the overthrow of the traditional family in its entirety, alongside, conservative movements. So Tolstoy, for example, one of the authors whom I analyze in my first chapter, or in the second chapter, the chapter after the introduction, was a fervent believer in sort of the sanctity of the family. And conservatives of his ilk were calling for mothers kind of to serve as the bulwark against all of this societal instability, right? So you have these two really opposing poles, where on the one hand, mothers are sort of endowed with this ability to save Russian society from all of this instability and tumult, and that they have to sort of embody the most quote unquote traditionally Russian values, the most conservative values upon which Russian society was founded. And they have to teach their daughters to sort of reproduce the hierarchy that has been at the foundation of Russian society, at the same time that you have these radical forces that are calling completely for the overthrow of the traditional family. And my selection of the two novels that I focus on in that chapter sort of partially motivated by an attempt to sort of to bring to the fore, two literary works, both with mother figures as central components to the development of the meaning of the text, but her sort of approaching, or both who are presenting self-sacrificial mothers, right, as the subversion rather of the myth of the self-sacrificial mother as sort of leading to the demise of these two very different families, but sort of the message that can be gleaned about the future of the family when one reads Tolstoy versus when one reads Saltykov-Shchedrin are quite disparate.
Tell us about Tolstoy's Anna Karenina. What kind of mother figure do you see there? What is the ultimate message of Tolstoy about motherhood?
Well, Anna Karenina is filled with all different kinds of maternal models. And in my analysis of the text, I look at some of the positive and some of the negative maternal models that he presents. But of course, I spend most of my time tracing what I term the devolution of Anna Karenina and the devolution of her maternal emotions. So when she first arrives onto the scene, she's been called by her brother Stiva. She's called from St. Petersburg to Moscow, and Stiva has been unfaithful to his wife Dolly, who is the mother of five children, right? And part of her Anna Karenina has been called kind of in an attempt to broker peace between Stiva and his wife, who's just found out that he's cheating on her with the governess, right? And my reading of that initial encounter between those two mothers is that Anna is relying on her kind of her maternal, the authority that her maternity invests her with, right? So she appeals very much to Dolly's, her maternal identity. She you know, asks in great detail about her children, right? And she kind of secludes, there's a meeting where the two of them are completely secluded, right? So it's this very much kind of, you know, it's two mothers, with the rest of the world, pushed aside, right? And she's able, eventually successfully to broker kind of this peace between her brother, Steva, and his wife. But the fact that she uses her maternal authority for a morally ambiguous goal casts doubt or casts a shadow over her maternal identity from the very beginning, right? Because we know, if we read carefully, the narration quite clearly tells us that, you know, Anna has committed several untruths in the course of trying to broker this peace, right? I mean, we know from reading Steva's own thoughts indirectly relayed through the narration that he has no intention of quitting his philandering, right? So the fact that she sort of uses her maternal authority to bring those two back together, but for a potentially morally ambiguous goal, sort of casts a shadow over her maternal authority. But she's presented, you know, early on as being a very devoted mother to her young son, Siriosha, right? And what I do in my close reading of the text is to show how after she meets Count Vronsky, how there is this internal battle that begins to unfold between her maternal emotions, which are very much inspired by, or I would say shaped by, knowledge of what the maternal myth in Russia consists of, right? So she knows that a mother is supposed to be self-sacrificial. She knows that a mother is supposed to, you know, think about her children before and beyond and above anything and anyone else. But as her affair with Vronsky unfolds, she begins to, there's a battle. The way that I write about it in the book is that there's a battle in her memory between, and I argue that memory has a very explicit and a clear moral component in Tolstoy, right? That memory is not something that is morally neutral. And that if we trace sort of the presence or the absence of her son Siriosha in her memories, we can see how eventually her desire for Vronsky wins out over her love for Siriosha. And what I describe as the sort of the nadir of Anna as mother occurs with the child whom she has with Vronsky, this little girl who doesn't get very many pages devoted to her in the course of the novel, but who is very clearly a peripheral to Anna's existence, right? She's born out of wedlock, out as a result of her affair with Vronsky. She's very peripheral to Anna's motivations. And the worst, I think the worst moment, the moment that portrays her in the most negative light as a mother, is when the little girl Annie falls ill and Vronsky is away on some business. And the little girl, so she writes to Vronsky, telling him that he has to come home. You know, this is toward the end of the novel where she's consumed with kind of jealousy and paranoia and, you know, all of those negative emotions that eventually climax with her suicide. But she writes to Vronsky saying that he has to come home right away because the daughter is ill. And then the daughter actually recovers. And there are several sentences where the narration describes how Anna is disappointed, right? Because by this point, the daughter is really nothing but a pawn, right? In her struggle for dominion, for power, for influence over Vronsky. So I guess in summation, what I do is I try to trace sort of Anna's, how she goes from being, you know, a good mother, a devoted mother. And there are several scenes in the novel that are quite poignantly relay the tenderness and the genuineness of her maternal sentiments early in the text. And then after she has run off with Vronsky, I think one of the most moving passages in the novel is when she sneaks into her son's bedroom on his birthday, right? He's been told that his mother has done horrible things and that he's not allowed to have any contact with her. But Anna, you know, sneaks into his room and they have this very tender exchange that really transcends verbal communication, which in Tolstoy is something memory is something that has a very clear moral component. And the most Tolstoy presents verbal communication rather that transcends the verbal as the most privileged form of communication. And it's very clearly portrayed in that scene with her son that they are able to reach this higher level of empathy and communication. So in my reading of the text, I trace, you know, what is it that happens within her character that can explain or motivates her, her journey from, you know, from good mother to bad mother, to put it quite simply, and how by the time that she commits suicide, there are really no traces of her maternal identity left whatsoever. One of the last thoughts that go through her mind before she jumps under the train is she remembers her girlhood and she's about to jump on the tracks and it reminds her of when she was young and diving into a body of water. So by the time her last thoughts are of a completely prematernal self. So by the time that the novel closes, you know, that process has been completed to the point where her maternal identity has been completely erased really from her consciousness.
Now, another female character in the novel, the Golovlev family, Arina Petrovna, she also rejects self-sacrifice for her own self-interest, you argue, but for very different reasons. And that goal could be summarized quickly as the financial success of her family, but that ultimately corrupts her family. Now, in the interest of time, may I move you on to the next period, Jenny, of the next major upheaval in Russian history, the revolution of 1917, and what that changed for motherhood and for societal notions of what motherhood should be.
Sure. So my argument in the chapter that's devoted to the 1920s is that you have the emergence of a completely new maternal ideal in this period of time, a maternal ideal that I summarize as the abandoning mother, right? The title of that chapter is the abandoning mother as positive role model. So the overarching question of that chapter is, well, how does maternal behavior that in the earlier time period in the time of Anna Karenina and of the Golovlev family in Imperial Russia, where a woman who abandoned her children would have been unequivocally viewed as a negative figure, as someone who has violated the maternal, all sort of standards for maternal behavior. So how does that get turned into something positive? And so I look at several popular texts. So this chapter has a focus on one canonical, what has become as known as a canonical work of the socialist realist mode, the novel Cement, but I also look at several much less well-known texts that were published in women's journals in the first half of the 1920s. And I chart how the image of a mother who abandons her children as long as it is in the service of the state, of the collective good, of the construction of this bold and bright and beautiful new society, how now this woman is portrayed as a positive model, as a model for other mothers to emulate. So I look at several short stories and one poem from women's magazines from the 1920s. And you know, neither of those texts are especially complicated, and they're certainly not kind of literary classics that will last through the ages, but I think they're really interesting cultural artifacts from that period of time. And in these, my argument in reading those two short stories and the poem is that they present, that each one presents, they were all published between 1922 and 1925 approximately, is that they present a radically an increasingly radical vision of the denunciation of maternity. So kind of climaxing in the poem, which I'm just trying to find part of it that I can quote, because I think it speaks for itself almost, you know, more articulately than I can speak for it, right? So this is about a woman who is so busy with her obligations to factory life and to her social activity on behalf of the new regime that she doesn't have the way the poem describes it. She's no time to look after her son or to bring him up. By day, she's at the factory behind a machine, and then it's a meeting and off to bed, right? So it sort of establishes the fact that there are responsibilities that supersede those of motherhood that are more important for society as a whole than individual motherhood. But it goes on to present this dilemma as one that is very easily solved, right? So the state has stepped in and provided communal childcare options that alleviate her burden or her attempt to reconcile her maternal identity with her striving to contribute to the building of the new society. And not only does it present her burden as being alleviated by the state, but it actually presents the state as a preferable parent, right? As being able to do a better job at raising her child than she herself could. And in the morning to the workshop again, so it is every day, every year, but her breast doesn't yearn for her dear one. Her little son won't perish. He's with the pioneer group, which is better than either mother or father. They give him good examples and prepare a steadfast fighter. Of course, this is in my translation, which is in the original Russian, it rhymes, so it's much kind of zippier than the translation that I was able to do, but you get the general meaning, right? So that the state is actually better prepared, better qualified, better able to produce the kinds of citizens that are necessary for this new society than individual mothers, right? So it's a brief window in Soviet history where a completely transformed or radically new maternal ideal emerges, right? It has a very sort of short shelf life. The abandoning mother as positive role model lasts really roughly about a year before she's replaced by other much more traditional ideals, models of Russian motherhood. But it is nonetheless, I think, a really fascinating period of time to examine from the standpoint of this question of the evolution of maternal ideals and maternal myths.
Right. It's such a massive paradigm shift. Suddenly guilt and innocence are nearly reversed. But this paradigm shift didn't last long. Didn't Stalin have something to do with it?
Right. Well, when you have, after the Stalinist revolution, you have much more traditional maternal ideals returning to the forefront. So you have the emergence, for example, of a much more in visual culture, of a much more overtly fertile feminine maternal body, whereas in the 1920s, you had in comparable visual culture, women represented in a much more sort of masculine way. And you have, well, you have changes in policy that are certainly central to this shift that occurs in the culture. So 1936, for example, abortion is outlawed. The Soviet Union was the first state to make abortion legal in 1920. And that policy was reversed in 1936 and then reversed again in 1955 or 1956. But in 1936, there was concern about a decline in fertility, a decline in birth rate. So you have the advent of much more avowedly pronatalist propaganda. You have the introduction of the heroine mother, who is celebrated in Russian visual culture and other forms of propaganda. And to be a heroine mother, you would have to give birth to 10 children, mm-hmm. right? So that was
minimum.
And you would... you would get, I think, you know, some monetary support and also, you know, your picture in the newspaper or some other such thing, right? So it's, you know, it's a return to a much more sort of traditionally feminine, traditionally, you know, fertile kind of maternal figure. But alongside that, you have the obligation to also fulfill your duties as a worker, right? So, you know, in distinction to ideals developing, especially, for example, if you look at the 1950s in American and European culture, right, the sort of emergence of the, you know, the happy housewife who devotes herself to caring for the family and the children were in the Soviet Union, you know, from the 1930s onward, you didn't have a choice. You were supposed to excel at both. You were supposed to be a devoted worker, a devoted crusader for, you know, the solidification of Soviet values and for the success of the Soviet project. So you were never let off the hook on that front. But after the 1920s, you know, from really the time of Stalin onwards, with, you know, some variations, but really from that time onwards, you were expected to be a great worker and a great mother, and to produce as many children as possible.
So it's a double burden, really, that is put on women at this time.
A double burden. In fact, some historians have referred to it really as a triple burden, because you not only had your obligations as a worker and as a mother, but you were also supposed to, you know, be involved in political agitation and political work and that kind of, you know, extracurricular, those kinds of extracurricular activities designed to sort of spread Soviet values.
Right. And so despite this hallowed notion of motherhood in the Stalin years, it sounds like actual motherhood was rather difficult.
I think that is a very safe conclusion.
Understatement.
I mean, you certainly had, you know, from the beginning till the end of the Soviet period, the emphasis was on, you know, industrialization, on expanding the industrial base, on the growth of the defense industry, certainly into the period of the Cold War. It was not on, you know, ensuring, you know, it was a command economy, right? So everything was centrally determined and centrally planned, and there was never any, there were always very limited resources devoted to ensuring adequate supply of consumer goods, you know. So, you know, most women, you know, I think both anecdotes and statistics bear this out, you know, spent the majority of their time, you know, waiting in line for one thing, you know, trying to ensure that their families were, you know, clothed and fed, and that, you know, pretty much took up all of their time. So,
What about the 1990s then, the third period of upheaval that you treat? How did the literature of the 1990s and the 2000s deal with notions of motherhood after the post-Soviet era?
Well, the chapter where I focus on the 1990s, I think, is probably the most complex and the most multi-layered, in the sense that I draw on a variety of sources. In addition to, I mentioned already, the novella by Petrushevsky that kind of inspired the whole project. I also look at a film from really the right on the cusp of the collapse of the Soviet Union and the beginning of the, it was still the Soviet Union when that film was released, but it's really a film that I think reflects this time that was, you know, right on the brink of the collapse. I also look at the Chechen conflicts of the 1990s as an extra, obviously an extra literary event, but I look at two maternal figures that emerge from that conflict. One was the activist mother. So there was a committee that was actually a committee of soldiers' mothers that actually emerged in the 1980s in the wake of the Afghanistan war, but that continued its activism into the 1990s. And they advocated, you know, for soldiers' rights, for transparency within the Russian military. You know, sometimes they spent quite a bit of time just trying to ensure that a soldier's body would be returned from a conflict area. And they very clearly utilized this moral authority that the mythology of Russian motherhood invested them with in order to kind of take on, you know, bureaucratic intransigence, to take on, you know, very high-ranking Russian officials, to try to accomplish, you know, positive change, to try to, for example, the Russian military has a terrible tradition of hazing, so they attempted to kind of try to change that culture. So on the one hand, you have this, you know, very noble mother who's, you know, fighting on behalf of her son, kind of using all of the force of collective Russian maternal mythology in order to accomplish, you know, valiant goals. And then on the other hand, you have this, the Chechen female terrorists, who were using violent means to try to avenge the deaths of their sons, their husbands, other family members as well. And I use sort of the dichotomy between those two female figures to parallel another really interesting, I think, dichotomy that developed in the post-Soviet period in the 1990s, which is between, on the one hand, this tendency to endow mothers with this superhuman ability to save Russian society, right? So in a way, the Committee of Soldiers' Mothers sort of harnessed this belief that, you know, Russian society is in such dire straits, and the only force capable of saving us now are the mothers, right? In fact, Andrei Konchalovsky, who is a fairly well-known film director, he's done some work in Hollywood as well, was quoted as saying that the only force that we have in Russian society that binds us together is motherhood. And he was quoted as saying this in the 1990s. So on the one hand, this sort of exaggerated tendency to endow mothers with the superhuman strength to save the nation during this, you know, period of tumult and chaos. And then on the other hand, to really attribute apocalyptic meaning to certain sociological indicators from the 1990s. And I'm referring specifically here to the declining birth rate. So in the early 1990s, Russia had a point where it had negative population growth. So fewer children were being born than people were dying. You know, children were being born than was necessary to replenish the population. And so this was treated in the media as a really cataclysmic kind of apocalyptic event. And if you read both the popular media and academic essays and cultural commentary from the 1990s, you notice this obsession with, you know, the potential dying out of the Russian race, right? And why is it that, you know, mothers are having future children? You know, what does this mean for us as a people? And on the other hand, you had over-exaggerated, I would say, focus on instances of mothers who either abandoned their children, mothers who mistreated their children, you know, instances of abuse, which of course are unfortunately a fact of life in every society. But what was exceptional, I think, about the way that these instances were covered in the Russian media was that there was consistently this sort of tendency to attribute, again, this kind of grave apocalyptic meaning to the fact that mothers are not having as many children as they used to have, and that the supposedly iconic Russian mother is no longer capable of reaching the kind of the heights of compassion and warmth and love and self-sacrifice that she was supposedly always able to reach. And then I structure my chapter according to those parallels, those dichotomies. And then I look at some works of literature that I argue are sort of hastening the dismantling of the myth of the iconic Russian mother. And in particular, I spend the majority of the chapter that deals with literary texts, I spend on a writer named, whom I mentioned already earlier, Lyudmila Petrushevskaya. And I think she's an apt kind of concluding author with which to end my study, because her maternal characters not only engage in the most sophisticated kind of psychological terror on their children, but she's also, her maternal characters rather, are also extremely cognizant of the fact that there is such a thing as the iconic, the mythological Russian mother. And they really sort of twist the aspects, the characteristics of this iconic Russian mother in an extremely manipulative way in order to accomplish their goals, while at the same time kind of not ever her narrators are almost to a one, extremely unstable. And we as readers never really quite can discern whether or not the mother herself thinks she's actually being a good mother by doing what she's doing, because she's so sort of consumed or saturated with the mythology of the iconic Russian mother that it's hard to know. And that's one of the things I think that makes her literature so interesting and so complex, is that we as readers can never definitively say, ah, this is a mother who knows she's being bad, or is this a mother who actually thinks that she, or who actually sincerely believes that her actions are motivated by an adherence to the mythological, the iconic, you know, warm, loving, self-sacrificial Russian mother.
In your conclusion, Jenny, you ask a question. I wonder if you'll answer it for us, and I'll rephrase it. Does the figure of the bad mother throughout Russian literary history mean that the maternal figure is totally central in Russian culture? Or does this recurring bad mother figure over time, and particularly during these moments of upheaval that you describe, does it mean that the maternal myth might be coming to an end?
I think it, I guess yes is probably the answer to yes and yes.
Okay.
I think, you know, on the one hand, the fact that you have this figure, you know, so rooted in pre-Christian and Christian belief systems, that is still so central and so such a touchstone for cultural development. I think that the fact that we still have mothers so centrally in Russian cultural production, whether they're good or bad, ultimately does reaffirm, I think, the continuing importance, the continuing centrality of that figure in Russian culture. You know, but then on the other hand, I think, you know, when you have writers, you know, from Saltykov-Shchedrin in the 19th century to Petrushevskaya in the 20th and into the 21st century, sort of mocking and attacking the iconic Russian mother, I think that ultimately does kind of problematize this notion that motherhood is something that binds Russians together, right? I think that's ultimately maybe the bad mother's most forceful, most significant assault on the mythology of the Russian mother, is that, you know, if we have authors and other producers of culture who continue to present a mother who does not neutralize familial chaos, who does not put her own needs behind those of her children, that ultimately kind of problematizes this notion of motherhood as an institution, as something that is capable of kind of transcending the chaos and the tumult of these periods that I've focused on. So I guess yes and yes is the short the short answer to your question.
Excellent. Thank you so much, Jenny, for talking to us about your book, Women with a Thirst for Destruction, The Bad Mother in Russian Culture. But before we end, I wonder if you would mind telling us a little bit about a second or a next project that you're working on?
Well, sure. Actually, my next project is quite unrelated to this earlier project. I was a theater major as an undergraduate, and I've always wanted to kind of go back and focus and develop that particular line of research and scholarship. So my new project is about post-Soviet drama. It's about a group of dramatists who emerged right around the same time that Vladimir Putin assumed power, so late 1990s, early 2000s. And they're quite young. Most of them are under 40. Many of them are under 30. And you know, generically, thematically, formally, they're quite distinct. But I think as a movement, it's a really exciting and dynamic development within recent Russian culture. So that's what my next book project will be about. So no mothers for now.
Well, that's
no more mothers for the time being.
Well, that sounds like a fascinating new project. We look forward to hearing about it perhaps on New Books Network in a few years, months maybe.
Thank you. So yes, months might be optimistic. Maybe
a year or two. Okay. Well, we've taken up a lot of your time. Thank you so much, Jenny Kamener.
Thank you so much. It was a pleasure speaking with you.